Yes, it is a real joy and a blessing to be here tonight, and we welcome all of you to this service. And I pray this time together will be an encouragement for you, and a time when God can speak to our hearts. Today, a holy brother, a dear friend, a dear brother, asked me a question. He said, if you would go back 30 years, and of course, he's a young man, he thought 30 years was a long time. He said, if you could go back 30 years, what would you do different in your life? And I said, brother, I'd have to go back at least 46 years or longer if I want to go back and make those things, do those things differently. But he wondered what I would do differently if I would go back 30 years. That was what he asked me. And tonight, I want to answer that question. That's what I like to do. And it will probably touch my heart if I have to answer that question, and I would like for it to touch yours. I'd like for that to happen. Now we're going to sing three songs by memory. And if you don't know these songs, if you don't have an acquaintance with these hymns, then you can worship by listening. And those that can sing them, I want you to sing them. And I think I'll just have you remain seated to sing the first two songs. And when we get to the third one, then we'll stand to sing the third song. And so these songs are all just two-line hymns. They only have two scores. And each of these hymns have four stanzas. And so it won't take very long we won't use up a lot of time to sing these songs, but they're very, very meaningful songs, and they will build the bridge between what we're doing here tonight. So let's sing these songs. And then I'll just lead the songs, you just follow along. You ready to go?
Lord, thou hast searched and seen. Yeah.
Churches. Maybe this doesn't apply to Illinois. Maybe this is only in Costa Rica. Maybe this is only among the beachy people. Maybe you Mennonites don't have this trouble. But we're having real difficulty reproducing the Pilgrim faith. We're having real difficulty transmitting the blood and fire gospel that has caused the death of many of our precious brothers and sisters around the world and throughout the years. I don't think very many people have to die for the Christianity that they have today. I don't think it would cost the lives of very many people the kind of Christianity that's prevalent today. Let's open our Bibles. You should be seated with your Bibles there to Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs 23. And he brought something to write on, but I don't see it writing to write with. I'm like a boy in school. Teacher asked him why he wasn't filling out his test paper. He said, well, teacher, I'm sorry, I don't have a pencil. And he said, the teacher said, well, then if you don't have a pencil, use your finger. And the boy said to his teacher, I could use my finger, but Mr. Teacher, I'm afraid you wouldn't be able to read it very well. And I could use my finger on there. I don't think you could read it very well. So I've got to do something else. I'm going to do something else. America is producing a generation of homeless children. And I know that when you hear that sentence, you agree with that. You don't have any trouble agreeing with that, that America is producing a generation of homeless children. And that means children without a home. And not only because of divorce and remarriage, not only because of same-sex marriages, not only because of professional mothers and daycare centers, not only because of substance abuse or crime or imprisoned parents, not because of dysfunctional home relationships, not only because of TV, internet cafes, and Blackberries, but along with all the busyness and social clubs and evening events and business pursuits and entertainments that this world has, they're all contributed to this. There's something even probably deeper that causes America to produce a generation of homeless children. And that is because these children live in homes where there are broken relationships in the home. There's something wrong in the home. And a child that's in a home that has broken relationships is living, he's a homeless child. Those are homeless children. Now, children can stand almost anything. Children are extremely resilient. They're tough little creatures. They can stand a lot of things. Children can stand poverty, no problem. In fact, one of the problems that Americans have when they go into foreign countries to do mission work is they see poverty there and they think it's terrible, and they feel that their first responsibility is to raise the standard of living to what they were used to living in their homes, into their communities. They want to raise that standard of living, and many of these people do not realize they have poverty. It is no problem to them. We should be careful about trying to provide a six-digit income for everybody in the world. Children can stand poverty. Poverty cannot destroy a home, neither can an accident, nor death. And not even necessarily parents that are overextended. Even those parents, if they're careful, can keep their homes together, if their relationships remain intact. Now, granted that what I was telling you about, what you heard, that long list that you heard, are all things that Satan is using to destroy homes. Now, Spanish has an advantage over English
And that when you read an English sentence, you have to wait to get to the end of the sentence to know what kind of a sentence it was. The Spanish tells you what kind of a sentence it is before you start the sentence. So we're going to, this sentence is going to be a question.
Neither America nor the Church of God can survive the curse of broken homes or broken relationships in a home. And you all know that just living together under the same roof does not make a home. It certainly does not assure a united home. Wherever relationships are deteriorated and severed, children right there become homeless. It's a difficult thing for children to be homeless. I ask you or suggest that you open your Bible to Matthew, to Proverbs 23. And we can read a lot here, but we'll just read verse 26. My son, give me thine heart, and let thine eyes observe my ways. And so I wrote a question on the board here. As if you were asking that question to your children. As if you're asking that question to one of your sons or one of your daughters. Do I have your heart? And of all questions, that question is very important. And there'll be no church at Lighthouse in a very few years if someone does not have a holy and a positive answer to that question. This church will die out. This church will come to an end. I think I can say this, that although people like, well, I'm not going to mention any names here because I don't want to embarrass anybody, but there are some great men whose books we read, whose books fill our library shelves. There's some people we have highly lauded, and we quote them, who were great preachers, and probably did good in the churches where they were serving the time that they served, but there are preachers like that that lost every one of their children to the world. You know, we can do a lot of good. But I became convicted of a truth one day that if I'm successful in any kind of an area of life and if I'm a failure in my home, then I'm a failure. When we teach our Costa Rican people about economic values and principles, we tell them that if they have a bad testimony in their economic life, then they have a bad testimony. In other words, you don't have a bad testimony when it comes to economics and then have a good Christian testimony. You just don't have it. If you have a bad economic testimony in your community, you've got a bad testimony. I didn't say if you're not wealthy, you have a bad testimony. That might be a bad testimony itself. Depends on how we live that. But if you have a bad economic testimony, you have a bad testimony. And if I'm a failure in my home, I'm a failure, no matter how successful I've been in other things. My son, give me thine heart. And let thine eyes observe my ways. Let's see how many of you are learning anything this week. What should we do when we hear text like that? What's the first thing we should do? What's one of the first things we should do when we hear text like that? Who was paying attention this week? I'm not asking Brother Oliver to ask that question. He wasn't here before. But some of you were here before. What should we do? Anyone remember? I'm not a very good teacher. You should ask yourself some questions. And I'm going to just suggest a question that I think all of you should have asked yourself by this time. The question is, how do I know if I have my son's heart? If you haven't asked that question, there's something wrong with our worship here tonight. We need to engage in worship. We need to engage and participate in what's going on. And it's one thing to ask that question when your child's 5 years old. It's another thing to ask them when they're 25. It's another thing to ask them when they're 45. And that having the heart of your child should still be working, still be intact when the child is 45 years old. And will be if you have the heart of your child. My son, give me thine heart, and let thine eyes observe my ways. But do I have my son's heart, or my child's heart, or my daughter's heart? Do I have that? That's a question you should ask. You see, it is God's will. I learned this. I'm not sure this may have been, Brother Oliver, at Newbie Bible School. I don't know where I first heard this. If I learned it there or heard it somewhere else. That it was God's will for His children to learn by instruction. It was not God's will that His children learn by experience. In other words, you don't need to go out here and make failures in life as a father and mother, and then if you made those failures, try to learn from your mistakes. The damage is done. Serious damage is done. Why learn by experience when we can learn by instruction? And here, the proverb writer is trying to give instruction to his home and give instruction to his children, and we as parents should be reading the instructions that are found here, and we should be interested in these instructions. And you may have heard me say this, but I was preaching in a state that's some distance from here quite a few years ago, and I was preaching to the parents of the assembly. There was probably someplace in 1,000 and 1,500 people present in that big tent that time. And I was preaching to them, and I was talking to parents, and talking to the parents about the needs, talking to the parents about their children, talking to the parents about their vision and their conviction, and talking to parents about getting the hearts of your children, talking to parents. And I was trying to plead with the parents, and the parents sat there and watched me. And then the tent was set up like this, and here at the front, the young people were sitting in the front of the tent. And the back, the older ones were sitting in the back. And there were several hundred young people sitting up here in these front benches, or front chairs of this tent. And behind me there was a curtain. And behind that, then there was a place for prayer. We prayed back there before the meeting in the evening, and there was a place back there for prayer. And I saw at the end of the sermon, I gave an invitation. And I was hoping some daddies, I was hoping some mamas, I was hoping someone would be sensing their needs. And I couldn't believe what happened. And these young people stood up. These young people stood up and came out of their chairs and benches and went out here behind this curtain. I think more than 50 of them went out there. I just couldn't believe it. And I wasn't talking to the young people at all. I was talking to their parents. And the young people got up and walked out. And why did they do that? I'll tell you why they did that. Because the young people wanted a relationship with their parents. And the daddy sat there. And when these parents saw their children going out there, what did they think? I wasn't talking to the children. I wasn't talking to the youth. It wasn't what they call around here youth night. And the parents sat there. And it's God's will that we learn by instruction. Our children should learn by instruction. And we should learn by instruction. And the instructions are here. And the instructions are here. We violate the instructions. The Proverbs is full of instruction. There's instruction in the book of Proverbs. It comes from the parent to the child. My son here. My son here. We have that. The Proverbs begin that way. Chapter after chapter, my son here, my son here, hear the wisdom, hear the instruction of your father. Forsake not the law of your mother. And here's a very important law. A very important law is in this text that we have before us tonight. Our Lord God cannot preserve a pilgrim people if this law is disobeyed. I'm going to show you the same thing in several other ways. Back to Proverbs 22, since you're already in Proverbs, go to 22 there. In verse 6, you people know it by heart. Train up a child in the way he should go. And when he is old, he will not depart from it. But that's conditional. There are conditions to that. We can't just grab that and say, see that? I trained them right, sent them off to Bible school. I had them in summer Bible school every year. They were in a Christian day school. I paid the tuition. They were properly trained. They'll not go wrong. There are other conditions here. This is not the only thing the Bible tells us about our responsibility as parents to the children. It's a vital responsibility. It's not the only one. Chapter 6, verse 20. The same Proverbs there. My son, keep thy father's commandment and forsake not the law of thy mother. Bind them continually upon thine heart and tie them about thy neck. When thou goest, it shall lead thee. When thou sleepest, it shall keep thee. When thou wakest, it shall talk with thee. For the commandment is a lamp, and the law is light, and reproof of instruction. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life, to keep thee from the evil woman, and so on. It goes on there. But my son, there's both a lamp, and there's a light, and there is a law, and there's a commandment. And keep the commandment of the father, and forsake not the law of thy mother. I'm going to go to Ezekiel 43. Do I have your heart? Do I have your heart? You think of your children. I don't know how many children you have, but you think of your children. You get on the list. You ask yourself that. And put the name of your child before that sentence and ask the sentence. Martha, do I have your heart? Samuel, do I have your heart? And be doing that as we go through the sermon tonight, this teaching tonight. Ezekiel 43, verse 12. This is the law of the house. Upon the top of the mountain, the whole limit thereof round about shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the house. And I'm going to take the liberty to change that word house to home. This is the law of the home. We want to look at that law tonight. Now look at one more reference. You already jumped over it when you went from Proverbs to Ezekiel. You jumped over Lamentations. Go to chapter 2. I'd like to read verse 19. Lamentations 2:19. Arise, cry out in the night. In the beginning of the watches, pour out thine heart like water before the face of the Lord. Lift up thy hands toward him for the life of thy young children that faint for hunger in the top of every strait. And this was referencing here the fall of Jerusalem. It was referencing the destitution and the hunger and the condition that was left there after that siege of Jerusalem, and people were left without food. And the lamentations here is that cry, that lament. But it should be another cry tonight. Arise, cry out the night, in the beginning of the watches, pour out thine heart like water before the face of the Lord. Lift up thine hands toward him for the life of thy young children. And every godly father should have that attitude. That should be our attitude. We find law here. A common Bible theme, you'll find it from the book, beginning of the book, especially from Deuteronomy on to the end of the Bible, you'll find a common link between law and heart. It's God's will that law be in the heart. We talked about that the first night, so we're going back to there again. There's a connection between law and heart. And law without heart is legalism. And law without heart produces traditionalism. And law without heart is dead letter. And law without heart is death. And law without heart is not transmitted. Law is transmitted, but faith is not transmitted. Law is transmitted, but life is not transmitted. Law is transmitted, but relationship with God is not transmitted. Well, that's just law and heart. And law in the heart. And that's what we must have here. This law that comes from the mother's heart. It was in the mother's heart. Forget not the law of thy mother. Forsake not the law of thy mother. It was in your mother's heart. And these commandments which I command thee that this day shall be in thine heart. It starts there. It starts in the heart. And if it's not in mama's heart, it won't be in the children's heart. If it's not in my heart, it won't be in the congregation's heart. If it's not in my heart, it won't be in the family's heart. It's in the heart. I'm going to give you the law that I see in this verse, Proverbs 23:26. The law I see there is this law. When I say law, I'm not talking about something that was written in the statutes of the city of Springfield. I'm not talking about something that was out of Washington, D.C., or something that the Sala Cuarta wrote in San Jose, Costa Rica. When I'm talking about this law, I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about an eternal principle that always produces the same results wherever it is practiced. We're using the word law in that sense tonight. And here's the law. The parent that has the heart of his children can know this, that both parental and divine law are written there if he has the heart of his children. You see, if we have the hearts of our children, then the law that's in our hearts moves with that, moves in that same direction, moves the children in that same direction. We have the heart of the children. And so there's an opportunity for transmission. There's an opportunity for reproduction. Because we have the heart of the children. And so the heart of the children is the first thing. Getting that heart. This is the law of the house, or this is the law of the home, as I'm applying it tonight. If the father and mother have a law that their family can clearly understand, then there's no doubt if they know what it is or not. Because every father, every child knows what his parents believe. And every child knows what his mother wants. And every child knows what his parents would wish for him, whether he's with the parents of whom or not. They can go off to a Bible school someplace 1,000 miles away, and the mother's not nearby at all. They know what mother expects of me and how I'm supposed to behave. And they know every minute when they're disobeying what mother would say. The mother is nowhere close by. And the mother did not say before they left, here's all the rules that you've got to keep while we're absent from each other. Mother never needs to say a word. They know. Now, mother and father have a clear law. They have a clear understanding. They've established some clear parameters for their family. There are things in our home that this is the way we do in our home. This is what we have in this family unit that we represent. Then the children know what that is. But, they might know it. But, is it in their heart? Now, I'm going to use this here for example. This is not a glass of water. This is a lamp. And if your children know what the law is, they know what is right, they know what you expect, they know what they should be doing, they know it, they've got a lamp. But when it's in their heart, there's a light. Before it's in the heart, they've got a lamp, carrying a lantern around. But when it's in their heart, and there's a big difference between those two things. The law in the heart produces the light. All right, let's start off here. That was an introduction. How do I know, or can I know, if I have my son's heart or my daughter's heart? How do I know, can I know, is it possible to know? Ask me another question. I think it's time for another question. Ask me another question. I didn't answer this question yet, but ask me another one.
How do I get to my child's
heart? Thank you, brother. If I don't have my child's heart. You say, Brother Dale, don't win that first part. Don't try to answer that question. I already know the answer to it. Don't take me there. I already know the answer. My father didn't have my heart, and I don't have my children's heart. Don't even bother to answer that. But I've got a question. You're sitting there, you're saying, I've got a question.
How can I get my child's heart? Is it possible to regain it if you've ever lost it?
That's one of the holiest questions you could have possibly asked tonight. Surely that question came to your mind, didn't it? if I ever lost it, can ever get it back. How can I know, can I know, if I have my son's heart? Well, let's look at some Bible examples. Mount Moriah, 3 days away. See, now, I can't do that in Spanish. In Spanish, we have to explain Mount Moriah, where it is, where it's found, what book of the Bible it's in, who's it talking about, what the context is. I don't need to do that for you. You already know that. Mount Moriah, 3 days away. Who am I talking about? And? All right, did he have his heart or not? And there's evidence of it there. There's all kind of evidence of it there. Listen to the conversations as they're walking up the hill. Listen to them talk together. When's the last time you talked to your son like that? Listen to that conversation going on between those two, father and son. Daddy.
Yeah, son. I'm concerned about something. What's that? I don't think we brought a lamb along. Yes, son. I think you're right. You talk about being put on the spot. That put Daddy on the spot. And they went on both together, the Bible says. After that conversation, they went on both together. And did Abraham have his son's heart? How did he get that? Let me ask another question. Did God have Abraham's heart? What do you think about that? How do you feel there? Abraham, Abraham, rise up early. Abraham, Abraham, take your son, your only son, Isaac, the only beloved that you dearly love, the only one. Isaac, take him along. I'm going to show you a place. Go there. When you get there, this is what happens. And Abraham rose early in the morning. Did God have Abraham's heart? Did Abraham have Isaac's heart? It's right there as a point. How do I respond when God talks to me? What is the evidence that God has my heart? It starts right there. Abraham had control of Isaac's heart. Isaac was too big for a man that age to just manhandle him and wrestle him down and be able to use a knife and do what he needed to do on that occasion after he built that altar. His son had to yield to that. Now David had Solomon's heart, but he did not have Absalom's heart. Isn't that a strange thing? Samuel did not have the hearts of his two sons, Joel and Abiah. Even though they served as judges, they were active in the church. Mary had Jesus' heart. Eunice had Timothy's heart. Do you have your son's heart? Do I have the hearts of my children? There are many reasons why a minister should spend a lot of time in prayer. Besides the fact that he has a family, besides the fact that family stands at a very unique place in the life of the congregation, a very vulnerable place, a very visible place, he has a congregation, and he has members in the church, he has sheep in the flock. And preacher, here tonight, you do not know you do not know what all is going on in the lives of your people. You don't know what all they're facing, especially me. I'm far away. And although there are some shepherds at home, they're taking care of things while I'm away, I don't know. I don't know. But we need to know if we have the hearts of our children. Well, there's evidence of there being law in the heart of the children. Let me give you some of those evidences. When you can tell your child to do something and they obey without challenging, they obey without murmuring. Maybe you had to tell your child no. And even though, listen parents, be tender with your children. Even though tears of disappointment flow from the eyes of your children when they were unable to do something that was of great interest to them, and they were anticipating it, and they thought maybe it would be nice if they could do it. but you felt as a parent on that occasion that it was not the appropriate time, and you said no, and the tears of disappointment come there, and you don't scold your children for that. You say, "I'm sorry, I understand. That's a real disappointment for you. I understand that's a disappointment, and I want to help you. I understand." But that can happen without rebellion. Those tears can flow without there being resistance. And those tears can say these words. Listen. "I'm willing, Daddy. I'm willing, Daddy." There's evidence of having your children's heart when they share the same vision that you as a father and mother have. We talked about the spirit of Elijah resting upon Elisha. That's something that somebody else said. Elisha didn't say that, but the 50 prophets said it. They said that the spirit of Elijah rests upon Elisha. And I told you Monday night that probably the greatest gift you can give your children is your spirit, if it's the right spirit. That's what parents do. They impart passion and vision and conviction to their children. And we see this as in Solomon taking up the preparations that David made for the building of a temple. And David made all kinds of preparations there, although, as you heard, he was a bloody man. He was a bloody warrior. And David never lost a battle, even though he had done wrong. And Solomon was raised to this warring father. And yet this man, as he conquered and gathered up all this bulting, all this booty, all this extra, all this who knows what you call it in your language, all this stuff that he got there, and the spoils, there's the word, I think. And he brought it over here. And he put that aside for the construction of the temple. And Solomon saw that. Solomon was just a young fella. Solomon was only about 18 years old when his daddy died. He saw that his preparations, and he caught that. And he saw his father sitting down and drawing blueprints. He saw his father's interest. He heard father talking to the prophet about it. He heard those things, and he caught that vision of his dad. Sharing the vision that daddy and mother had. Taking up the values of father and mother, the lifestyles of father and mother, the convictions of father and mother, the standards that their parents stood for and taught, taking that up. I think of Jonadab and the Rechabites, and I think of them living there out in the country in their tents, and they would not come into the city. They wouldn't live in houses, and they would not drink wine. And those things that their daddy taught them, they took that up. He had their hearts. He had the hearts of his children right down through the generations. He had their hearts, and they did this. And though the rest were doing it, everyone else was doing it. See, what did Paul Weaver say, Alan? He said, "No texting, no internet, and no movies." Right? Did you say it right?
Let's say it another way, so these people, they can make more sense out of it. No texting on the cell phone, no internet hooked up in the home, and no videos.
That sounds pretty stiff. Someone bought my daughter one of these digital cameras, first one we ever had in our home. They bought that for her, a digital camera. And I didn't know it. She asked me to go with her when she bought this camera. They gave her the money to buy it. And I was supposed to go with her to the store. And so we went into the store, and they had these cameras in there, and she thought that looked like a good one, and it seemed like it would be. And so she bought that. And after we got the thing home, we found out that camera, digital camera, had a video capability. You could take pictures with it like this, or you could... And make the video of it, and maybe play it and noise it and do that. And I said, "Loretta, I want you to enjoy your camera. It's a nice gift. Someone gave you a lot of money there to buy that. But I wouldn't feel very good if I knew you were using the video part of that camera."
That was quite a few years ago. Other people are doing it. People do it all around us. They do that. Video is nothing. Take up the values of the parents. And that's what Moses did. When Moses was come to years, he did that. He didn't have an opportunity to do it at the beginning. But when Moses had come to years, that's what he did. He took up the values of his parents. Even first-generation Christians can pass the torch on to their children. Eunice did it. God knew that Abraham would do it. Passing that torch on to the children. And there are also evidences that those relationships have been severed with our children. That the heart is not with Daddy. Nor with his religion, nor with his position. In short, the opposite of everything I've said so far would be evidences that we don't have the heart of our children. But we can lose the hearts of our children at the same time have gracious words between us and carefully chosen words and expressions of appreciation and certain degrees of respect, even when we don't have the hearts of the children. There can be a courtesy about it, a moral courtesy. Yet if the heart is not there, evidence will follow that the heart of the children is not with us. Let's look at a few of those evidences. Your children don't want to identify with you. They want to go to church in their own car. They want to leave after you've left. They don't want to tell you where they're going. They feel a little ashamed to bring their friends home. They feel better in a different country, a far country, like the prodigal did. A world where father and mother are unknown and cannot enter. This is my own turf. I'm there alone. That indicates a serious breach. That would come later in life. That doesn't happen to a child that's 5 years old. Doesn't happen to 15 either, but it happens by the time they're 17. And this can happen without the son even moving out of the home or the daughter. He can still be quite near, but his heart's not there. And they might take action, do something that hurts daddy and mother. Tramps on their heart. Words said, decisions made. That grieves mother terribly. Yet it is done. The heart bond is already severed. And what does it matter? Absence from each other. Daddy's over here, this part of the house, the children are over here. The children don't come to see where daddy is. Mama, where's daddy? Oh, good. You go find daddy. They do that when they're 3 years old. But we need to do that when they're 23. Come find daddy. This absence, this silence. We're together in the same room, not talking. Yes, we can talk about the chores, and we can talk about the business, and we can talk about the plans for tomorrow, and we can talk about what we're supposed to do, and which pickup truck you should take, and we can talk about that stuff, and where we're going to stop for dinner. We can talk about that, but we can't talk. We don't talk. No heart-to-heart communication. There's business, but there's not fellowship. We need one another's contribution to make the project work. But we're not paying attention to the feelings of each other. If you'd study the life of Absalom and the relationship he had with David, it's a terrible story. The summit is lonely, and daddy does not see it. He is busy preaching, traveling, starting churches, interviewing, going and going and gone. He didn't see it. We have an evidence that the relationship is severed when the children accept daddy's economic values, but not his spiritual values. We have not transmitted the faith. But now we see it too late. Careless with devotion,
with prayer time. Careless of daddy and mother, careless with brotherhood agreements. Casual observance. Casual dress, casual behavior. Daddy and mama, a life without an altar. No altar light. A life without an altar. You know, when my child does not learn from little on up, from birth on up, or to be more specific, from 3 months of age on up, when my child cannot learn from 3 months of age on up to bow down and to surrender and to be at peace about it, I have work to do. When from little on up there's resistance and squalling and tempers and fightings, there's work to do. Peace in the home. Peace in the heart. When direction is given, peace. I just want to say a word here to parents of young children. Your preachers make mistakes. Your church is faulty. I don't care if it's an Eastern church, a Beachy church, a Pilgrim church, a German Baptist church, Methodist church, Baptist church, Catholic church, your church is faulty. Brothers make mistakes. Pastors make mistakes. You might think that you're worthy of something better than what your congregation offers you. You might think that you're worthy of something better than what your pastors can provide for you. And I'm not going to criticize that or discount that possibility, but I want to say this. Be careful of the spirit that you transmit to your children about your church and about your pastors. Be careful what your children hear and learn from you about that church that you have questions about and criticisms of. You see weaknesses in it. I will assure you that if you're not careful, your children will bring all that back to you within the next 10 to 15 years. It will all come back. It just behooves us to be real quiet apart, real careful. What we say about brethren who are called to pastor, to guide the flock of God. And they're all faulty people. Brother Aaron Schenck told me many years ago, he said, every prince limps. He was talking about Mephibosheth. He said, every prince limps in one area or another. As you've heard several times this week, we don't know enough. But I think those are some of the areas where we lose the hearts of our children. There are many other ways too. Right? I'm sorry I don't have time to explain all the ways, all the damage that we can do. And I'm just touching on a few things here tonight. I trust the Spirit of God will show you the rest of it. But how do we know if we have the hearts of our children? I was asked to speak to a 17-year-old girl. Was in the States, in a state that's very distant from here, very far from here, more than 1,000 miles from here, close to 2,000. And
was told this girl's at home alone, so we went there. My wife and I and daughter went there, and she invited us in. She was sitting on a couch. She was sitting in a little sofa couch, and she was jammed up there with her knees tucked up under her chin, and she was as defiant as could be, like a tiger down in there and ready to pounce. She was down in there, and her lips were set, and her forehead was set, and this. Evidently, this was not her agreement. It must have been someone else's agreement that we come there. And so I knew that I was in a very disadvantage here to help this young lady. And I began to talk to her about her relationship with her father. And you just about see the spit and the fire coming out of that girl. And the resentments and the anger, the pent-up feelings. And I pitied the poor girl. Pity the girl. She's destroying herself and being destroyed. This atmosphere was pretty static in there. Pretty high voltage. And my daughter came over to where I was standing trying to help this young lady. And put her arm up on my shoulder. And laid her head down on her arm. And I could tell that this interview was hard for my daughter. I just want to urge you to get the hearts of your children. I don't know what else I can say. Get the hearts of your children. Make sure you have the hearts of your children. What can I do to earn my son's heart? Is that your question? If I don't have my son's heart, can I ever gain it back? Is there anything I can do to gain the heart of my child if I once have lost it? It's easy for me to tell you how to lose the heart of your child than what it is for me to teach you how to gain it. This is where I'd like to sit down and or kneel down and weep and let you finish the sermon. I just prefer to kneel down and weep and let you finish the sermon. You may have heard the story about Gabriel and his cat. Gabriel was our second son, and we had four children by that time. He was the second son, third child, and there was one younger than him. Younger than he. And the mother cat had four kittens. So each of the four children claimed one of these kittens of their own, for their own. And these little kittens started to grow, and they were cute little kittens. The children enjoyed their kittens. We didn't have very many things in Tennessee. We had a very difficult time living there. Economically, it was a very, very difficult time. The children had their little kittens, and they liked their kittens. And it was time to do chores out to the dairy barn, and the older children had to do the chores. And Gabriel followed along behind him. He was a little bit younger. And one of these little cats was in the doorway of the milk room. And there was a sliding door there. And one of the children was kind of angry and in a hurry. And threw that door shut, rolled that door shut, and pinched that cat in the doorway. And Gabriel came up on the scene and saw his little pussy cat pinched in the door. And grabbed up the cat. It was a Sunday evening. Sunday afternoon, and he came running into the house with his cat. And I was in the room preparing a sermon for that evening in the service. And Gabriel came running in the door and said, "Daddy, Daddy, my cat, fix my cat. Daddy, fix my cat." I said, "Gabriel, your cat's dead. Take it outside." And that poor little boy took his cat. And he was as rejected as could be. He was as devastated as could be. He carried that cat to the door. And I no sooner said that than I realized the terrible thing I had done. I jumped out of my chair, followed him out the door. When I got to the door, he laid the cat down on the porch. I said, "No, son. It has got to go outside." And he took it out to a tree, big oak tree in the yard, in the shade there at the bottom of the tree. He laid the calf in the shade under the tree. I said, Gabriel, you and I must do something with the calf. And so we took the cat out in the woods. He would do something with the cat. But something happened to Gabriel's heart that day. And a little over a year later, no, it was a little longer than that. It may have been several years. I got a terrible phone call at 11:30 one morning. And we had half an hour to drive. And I finally got there to these people's yard, and they're under a tree in the grass. With a sheet over top of him was that same son. And I could not fix the cat. And nobody could fix the boy. And he was gone. And in our moments of impatience, our selfish behavior, our big disimportance, we don't see the sheep lying upon the sun in the grass. What'd you do, Brother Dale? You had to go back and do it over again 30 years later. Go back and do it over again, Dale. Understand? You'd have done something different. You've got a child that's lonely. Who knows why he's lonely? I could give you illustrations, but he'd be here all night. I can't do that for you. You have a child that's lonely. Do you know your child's lonely? Hypocrisy can never win a heart. It's an awful experiment. It's an awful exercise. I'm going to show it to you. It's a painful exercise, but go to 1 Samuel chapter 8. I'll show this to you. It's painful to do this. But what happened to Samuel? Samuel did not have the heart of his children. This godly boy that said, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant here." This godly boy, his mother gave him a coat every year. This godly boy, he was raised in the temple. This godly boy, he receives messages from heaven for Eli and for the future of Israel. This godly boy who none of his words fell to the ground. This godly boy who went from place to place and judged Israel. This godly boy, he grew up. This godly boy who saved Israel from the Philistines. This godly boy who is now a leader and a redeemer in Israel. And where is his own home? And how did his own home turn out? And then this one who is so active and so busy and so effective. And look at 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 1. "It came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of the firstborn was Joel, the name of the second Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, and took bribes and perverted judgment. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah, and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." This young man had such a holy and a beautiful beginning. Here he is at the end of his life. Look at him. I've often pondered this. I don't know what you Bible scholars have to say about Samuel's mistake. I don't know what you have to say about it. I'm going to make four statements about Samuel. We know where Samuel's home was, but we have not one record in Holy Writ about his home life. We know where his house was, but we have no record at all in the whole of the Bible of his home life. There's no record in all Scripture of Samuel's wife. Certainly nothing of his relationship to her. Nothing of her relationship to her sons. Nor do we have anything about Samuel's relationship to his sons. We have no record of him admonishing or training his sons. Yet he knew that this was the very reason for Eli's failure. He heard that and knew that.
You're in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Look at chapter 7, verse 3. And Samuel spake unto the house of Israel, saying, to all the house of Israel, saying, if ye do return to the Lord with all your hearts, then put away the strange god Ashtaroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord, and serve him only. And he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. He did not communicate that to his boys. That truth that he has there. Let's go a little deeper. And I want your hearts tonight. So get your hearts into this. There are crisis points in family life. Sickness. There are crisis points in family life. There are things that cause a family to struggle. I'm going to name a few things. One of them is when your children do wrong. When your children shame you. When children shame us. It's a crisis moment. Like Absalom did for David. When our children shame us and make mistakes like Absalom did for David. What do we do when our children shame us? How do we respond to our children when they are wrong? What do they feel from us? You may paddle your children when they're wrong. Paddling will not divide your children from you if you do it right. You do it biblically. You have control of yourself. If your children know you're in control, the children know the spirit with which you're doing it. If you have the grace and the composure of mind to sit your child down, explain to them what has happened and what you plan to do about it, and why you're going to do this, and what the result's going to be in their lives, and you can explain it to them before you get this paddle busy, and you have control of yourself, you know how you're going to use that paddle and how often you're going to use it, and you have that clear in your mind, and you're controlled of it, the paddle will not do damage to your children. I had a daughter that was extremely tall by the time she was 11 years old. That's the last time I paddled her. And I remember very well what happened when I was done. I was not prepared for it. I was done and she turned around. And she was crying. And she grabbed me around the neck with her arms and said, I love you, Daddy. I love you, Daddy. That's what she said. By that time, her daddy was crying too. But the paddle does the damage. There's something else that does the damage. We're talking about crisis points. When death and tragedy comes into the family, and parents are suffering and struggling, but are we meeting the needs of our children? They're struggling too. Moving into a new culture, a new community with our children, especially the children or older children when this happens. And what is worse than that is that the mission fields are filled with tragedies. It's a book that I hope nobody writes. I could give you story after story of tragedies on the mission field. I could give you story after story after story. Fallen preachers, fallen preachers' wives, fallen preachers' missionaries' children. Adjustments, losses of friendship, changes in these social adjustments for the children, difficult moments for the children. Unwholesome influences from among the other youth in church or from the school. And we don't need to criticize the school nor the church. There's something we need to do about this. Sometimes there's free time. There's entertainment possibilities that can sow tares among the weak. We need to be aware of it. Turn my son's heart. I must take time to give him my own heart.
It's not really easy to go on here because I can just think of time after time and thing after thing. One example after the next of extremely difficult struggles that children have faced. That my own children have faced. I didn't always respond to it right. I'd be glad to do it over again. I'll never be able to do it ever again. Turn my son's heart, I must take time to give him my heart. It starts there. But it starts with me giving my heart to God. If I want to have my son's heart, I should give my heart to God, and I should give my heart to my own father, though I am 50 years old or 60. I should give my heart to my own father if I'm 40 years old and never done it. I should do that. If I want the hearts of my children, I should make sure that my father has my heart, even though we didn't have a good relationship when I was younger. We should certainly do that. If you want to hear your son's sorrows, tell him yours. If you want to hear him tell you where he has failed, let him hear you say where you have failed. Take time to communicate the way Abraham did with his son, the way Boaz did with his workers. Tell your children how you came to your convictions. Let them see the story of God's grace in your life. Be sure they know about your own altar life, your own prayer life, your own victory over sin. Let them see in your life mercy for the needy. Let them see in your life compassion for the lost. Let them see in your life your willingness, your sacrifice, what you're willing to do to help others. Let them see that. What are your true values? Where is your affection? What I will transmit to my children is what my affection is. I will transmit my affections to my children, though they be noble affections or not. Did you understand it this way, or how did that happen there? Would you tell me how you saw that? Tell me just how that happened there. Can you remember how that was? And he brings that out, and you try to help him find your right way. The words we say about each other. Do we weep for the needs of the church, or do we gossip about the needs of the church? Do our children hear us interceding for the needs of others? Or are prayers a form of spiritual gossip? Can we face issues without taking divisive sides? Our children are watching. What are Daddy and Mother going to do? Do you stand for a clear, committed Bible position? Or are you here one day and over there the next? Do your children know very well that you're looking for freedoms? For more expression for yourself. I had a father one day that was losing his children to the world. This was not a father from one of our churches. It was in several countries away from where we live. His father came to see me, and he was losing his children, and they didn't have a church of their own. He didn't know where to go to church, and nothing fit, nothing worked. There wasn't any place that he could fit in. He was living entirely too loose a life. I said, brother, this might sound a little strange to you, but I give you a suggestion. I'd like you to think about it. I think if you and your wife could agree to find a safer, a church with a more careful application, a church with a more careful position, and I think if you and your wife would agree together before the children that you will give your support to this kind of a congregation, and you want them to appreciate that you and your wife are going to take this position and maybe take a step that's a bit restrictive for your own children. I think it's going to be a way of saving your family. I was preaching at Beachy Church one time. The minister there had, in the congregation, he had some practices there that many conservative Beachy churches would not have. It's his home. I was surprised how loose it was in the home. I stayed there for a week. At the very beginning of the week, he told me about some of the things they're doing in their home that I'm not quite sure about. he just casually mentioned this, you know, kind of a, but this is what we do here. You just don't mind that when you're here with us in the home. But things weren't going real well. I left there on a Monday morning after the week was over to go to another place, and he took me to the place where I needed to go meet somebody. He said, Brother Dale, I want to tell you something. When I go back home, my family's expecting me to bring up a meeting in the living room. And there are several things that my wife and I decided this week that we're going to change in our home, and we're going to ask the family support. This man had a wayward daughter. He had a sinful daughter. She was really in bad shape. His other children were struggling, and he got all the family together and did what he said. He told them, we're going to make some changes in our home. My mother and I have agreed to this. We like your children's support. We're going to put some things away we have here. A couple of months after that, he called me on the phone back to Costa Rica, called me and said, my daughter just got converted. She gave her heart to God. It's a beautiful experience. Looseness and carnal living and a careless attitude is the wrong thing to transmit to your family, dear people. It's the wrong thing to give to your children. Do you stand for a clear, committed Bible position? Can you appreciate a different perspective and yet at the same time humbly explain why you have the perspective that you have? Can you do that before the brothers? Can you humbly listen and appreciate what the other brother is saying at the same time? Explain to them with a broken heart why you see it the way you do? Can you wait then for the Spirit of God to work in that meeting and begin to bring these thoughts and hearts together? Do you accept criticism gratefully? Your children know if you do or not. Include your family in your ministry. Include your family in your business. Include your family in your family project. Let your children know you need them. Let them know the success of it depends upon them. Let them know you can't do it without their help. If they ever make a public mistake, if your children ever make a public mistake, stand beside them and identify yourself with them. Let your children know in their worst and most difficult moment that Daddy and Mother are here. And yes, you did wrong, but we are here to help you. We want you to feel our love to you, even though you're wrong. I'll tell you one more thing. That's what Jesus Christ did for me. And that's why He won my heart. Stand for prayer.